From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The most novel revelation in a new documentary about the history of alcohol in Utah is that there is much of a history. Some are going to be surprised just how much booze was flowing in the early history of the state. Yes, this was a place settled by Mormons, but the early version of a member wasn't as scandalized by liquor because these were frontier communities, and in such places, alcohol was just a way of life. The documentary quotes Mark Twain's observations about the local homemade whiskey. It was called Valley Tan. Twain referred to it as a refresher of Mormon invention. Tradition has it, he wrote, it is made of imported fire and brimstone. Today in the program, we're profiling the new film, and we're talking about the pioneers of alcohol in Utah, past, but also present. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So in a state where the legislature has created a law that says if you're in a restaurant, you cannot make a drink in front of the public, it might be a surprise to learn that in the early days of Salt Lake City, there were so many saloons and bars on Main Street, it was actually referred to as Whiskey Street. And I know some of you are saying, wait, Salt Lake City, home of the Mormon Church, where alcohol is prohibited among its members? But you have to understand, when Mormons settled this place in the 19th century, they thought about alcohol differently. It wasn't really the taboo it is today, not in many ways. And don't forget, this was a frontier outpost. People weren't always so delicate, and alcohol was really just a way of life. Well, today in the program, we're talking about the history of alcohol in Utah, which is a story told in a new documentary which is premiering this week on the local PBS station KUED. It's a film about history for sure, but it's also about the pioneers of alcohol in Utah, both past and present. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Tyler Meesom is joining us here in the studio. He directed and produced the film. It's called Beehive Spirits, and it's going to be airing on KUED Channel 7. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. You may recognize Tyler's voice and his work. He also directed the award-winning documentary Sons of Perdition. And Tyler, welcome. Thanks for being with
us. Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me.
I have some other people here in the studio I'm going to introduce in just a moment. Gentlemen, welcome. Hold off. We'll talk to you in just a second. I wanted to start, Tyler, with you to talk about – well, let me ask you this first. So I just learned that the Deseret News will not run an ad for this film. The Salt Lake Tribune will. And we should mention, for those who don't know, the Deseret News owned by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the LDS Church. What does that say to you? Just how dicey an issue this is in the first place?
Well, I can't speak for the Deseret News. I'm a loyal Trib reader anyways. So, in making this film and deciding to do this film, if there's one subject that many people are very divisive on either side of the fence, it's alcohol in the state of Utah. There are those who wish that there would be more alcohol and it would be easier, and there are those that would like to see prohibition brought back. It's a very divisive issue, and it has been that way from the moment the Saints landed here. And
Do you think it was at first?
I think it's more so now than it was back then. We don't know exactly when the Saints started making alcohol. I know that among the first crops they started growing in the state was barley. And I don't know how many things you can do with barley outside of make beer and maybe a little bit of bread. But it's always been kind of a divisive issue. And the essence of any good story is conflict. It's drama.
Yeah.
And it is inherent in alcohol in Utah.
So was this the thing that was sort of interesting to you, was that conflict?
Well, we early on decided to kind of stay out of the contemporary politics of alcohol in Utah. It's so vast and so ever-changing. And even when we started the film, it's changed quite a bit. We've seen a loosening of licenses. We've seen the changing of zoning mm-hmm. to allow pubs within residential areas. So we kind of stayed away from that. And we more focused on it just... It's too big. And we, it's a 30-minute documentary.
Tyler,
it's not Roots.
But you're talking about conflict. There it is, right?
Right. And we knew that. And we knew that it would be so vast and so difficult to tell every story within that. Sure. Now, we did actually interview a number of people. We interviewed Senator Wadups. We interviewed Senator Ross Romero. We talked to the former DABC chairman. Mm-hmm. We talked to Jay Edgar. Edgar, who owns the Mix, who kind of circumvented the laws in order to get his bar a convention center, he called it, and he was able to get a liquor license. And then when we got into post, we just kind of realized, you know, it's just so vast and so difficult to tell that story in 30 minutes that it's best left to be told as character pieces. And we found three fascinating characters, and that coupled with the history, which is frankly more exciting than any contemporary politics, we decided to tell that story.
Well, you mentioned the three characters. Let me introduce them. They actually happen to be here. Greg Scherf is with us. He's the founder of Wasatch Brewery. And Greg, welcome.
Thanks, Doug. It's very nice to be here. A big listener, so it's kind of fun to be here in your studio.
Good. Well, welcome. Thanks very much. David Perkins is with us. He founded High West Distillery, and he's joining us here. David, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And Colin Fryer is with us, founder of Castle Creek Winery. That's down in Moab. Colin, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's great to be here, and it's a good chance for us to kind of shed some new light on a very controversial subject.
Well, I want to start with that. It seems obvious, right, that alcohol would be controversial. I guess it doesn't seem obvious to everybody, but what do you think the essence of that is? I mean, I think that is so interesting the Deseret News wouldn't even air an ad for this. What do you guys make of that? Greg, you start. What do you think you understand it by now?
No, I don't pretend to understand it, but I think it's largely where there's a controlling entity where we have been known for our lack of separation between church and state, and the will of the church in this matter can impose their thinking on the people here in Utah. And I think they try to do that delicately and try to do that with a certain amount of prudence so that they don't create a riot in the street. But at the same time, they're not shy about imposing how they feel about liquor and the consumption of liquor. And it's not like any other place in the country, really.
David, what's the impression, though? Do you think the central perception, let's say, of the average Utah lawmaker, which I dare say would be white, male, and Mormon, and never had a drink for the most part, I would guess, that they're admitting. What's their understanding of alcohol, would you say, Utah's lawmakers? That it's scary? I mean, do you understand?
I think it's a social and a moral issue, and you know, we indeed all have different social and moral values, and I think – you know, mostly treated with respect, and the understanding of the differences are treated with respect. But I think, indeed, you know, they look at it with different eyes, and you know, their job's to make rules, and you know, they may not always fit what everyone in the state wants.
But do you think the perception is that it's just by, in essence, it's not just morally bad; it's dangerous?
Oh, indeed, sure. I mean, absolutely, and you know, they want the right thing. And we just get to the right thing through different means, and that's where the conflict is.
Give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt.
Oh, indeed. I mean, I think we all want the right thing. I mean, we all want, you know, responsibility, and we know it can be abused, and we're in the business where, you know, we have to get insurance in case it does get abused. So that's the last thing we want.
Yeah.
And that's the last thing they want. And, you know, so I do think we all want the right thing, but just how we get there, that's where the conflict
that's
is.
That's the question. Colin, how do you see it?
Well, I go back to the fact that, you know, alcohol consumption is legal in Utah, has been since Prohibition, and that we kind of struggle as merchants and businessmen to find our place in that that jungle. But it has been changing, and it has been somewhat enlightening, at least in my experience. And, you know, the demographics and the population of our state have been changing. Over the last 50 years, the bigger dominance of the LDS Church has started to give way to new people that have come in, and there's new ideas, and our sense of culture is changing a little bit. And so as that changes, our liquor laws are changing, albeit sometimes a little slower. But I see hope on the horizon, and, you know, we've had some good positive changes lately.
So let's – I want to talk a little bit about this history because I want to get all of your perspectives sort of on it. The early history, Tyler, which you touch on a lot, and I guess it's kind of the most, as I've said, it's sort of the most novel kind of surprise, the fact that there was so much
mm-hmm. yeah.
alcohol in,
there
this,
was so
in these parts
much
in the
alcohol.
Early days.
And much like today, it was kind of what we're facing, which is there's so much alcohol and the church didn't really care for it much, although they were a bit the word of wisdom was a little bit less enforced at that time, and we can talk about that a little later.
Yeah, we will. I'd like to. But
they always had this double edge, which is they don't want alcohol, but yet they know how much alcohol, how the sale of alcohol brings revenue to the state. In 1871, two-thirds of the state's revenue came from the sale and distribution of alcohol. That's a large chunk of the revenue. And today, $300 million of it comes to the state. Now, there were breweries up and down the state of Utah. There were distilleries. There were wineries. They were large and small. One of them was the Salt Lake Brewing Company. It was one and a half city blocks. Salt Lake City blocks. Those are very large blocks. And it was pumping out 100,000 barrels of beer a year. I mean, what are you putting out?
About 40.
About 40. And Greg drinks 3,000 yes. of them himself. So, you know, so double what Greg alone is putting out.
Yeah.
And they were putting that out themselves. So there was a lot of it. There was whiskey. There was wine. There was a lot of beer. And I think there may have been more than there is now.
You know, I was struck by one thing that there are a lot of these terrific historical photos in the piece. And there's one, I don't remember which brewery it was, but there was this kind of marketing. It was like a billboard or something. And it said, I think it said something like water for the farm, beer for the farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
Which raised this question to me. So who were they marketing these things to? I mean, I'm guessing most of these farmers were Mormons. Were Mormons drinking more beer in those days? I mean, they were making 100,000 barrels of beer each year, and who was drinking all of this? Surely it couldn't have been Gentiles.
Well, like I had mentioned, the word of wisdom at that time was a little less enforced. It was more of a principle than it was a rule. In 1921, the LDS Church made it a requirement in order to enter the temple to obey the word of wisdom. And coincidentally, that was during Prohibition. So drinking alcohol wasn't so much immoral as much as it was illegal.
Yeah.
So before that, it was kind of frowned upon, but it wasn't enforced. Now, at the time, Utah was basically, there was the two M's. It was either Mormons or minors. And Mormons didn't drink that much, but minors, they drank a lot. And there were a lot of homesteaders, there were a lot of farmers, there were a lot of minors. And I think they were the ones, for the most part, drinking.
You say this, David, in the film, where you talk about the fact that, you know, this was a frontier place. So alcohol was just kind of a way of life, right? I mean, whiskey, distilling, those sorts of things, this was just a part of day-to-day life, I guess. Is that how you see it?
Well, we know a lot of households had stills, and indeed it was just a valuable commodity. You didn't have medicine necessarily, and you know, we know there are lots of stills in the state just from the old archives. But that was happening everywhere in the country. And, I mean, America was a nation of boozers. We drank a lot as a country.
Yeah.
More so than most other countries. And, you know, that was just, like we say, a way of life.
Because the realities of the frontier were pretty stark, I guess, right? I mean, and you didn't have anesthetics. I guess it did have its practical purpose. It took the edge off as well.
Well, life wasn't wonderful back then either.
Right.
You know, and it wasn't just the frontier, it was the cities. And, you know, then it got out of hand, which is why the prohibitionists came into play.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of the reasons. I want to get to that. I think it's interesting. Pioneers, the Mormon pioneers, they had liquor. They made liquor, of course. Do we know what that early alcohol was like? Do you guys have a sense of was it any good?
I suspect the beer was quite good. Salt Lake Brewing Company, the original Salt Lake Brewing Company, had a reputation for making really good beer, and there was no reason why it couldn't be achieved. I mean, there's nothing that miraculous about making good beer. The ingredients were close by. It wasn't as if you were in where I always look at Colin in the wine industry, where that, to me, is more challenging in the sense that you're at the mercy of what the grape does that year and how the grape comes out. But, you know, we can't go back and taste it, but I suspect the product was, you know, quite drinkable.
Well, David, you tried to make a Valley Tan. You tried to make a whiskey.
Yeah, about Valley Tan. Explain, David. Explain what that was. This was
well, we don't know a whole lot about it in terms of what the recipe was, but we liked the name and we wanted to tell the story because it is a fun story, and you know, having Porter Rockwell on that just amplifies the funness of the story. But Valley Tan was a whiskey, and you know, now we drink aged whiskey, and that's a modern phenomenon where you're drinking it 2, 3, 4, 6, 10 years old. Yeah. Back then it was in the barrel, and it was in the barrel long enough to get it to the market. So they were drinking it very young, and young whiskey's not that good in general. But indeed, Mark Twain did say it tasted like imported fire and brimstone, which sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah. On the wine side, like Greg alluded to, it's a little harder to make wine. First of all, you've got to get the grapes in the ground, and you got to wait 7 or 8 years before you even have a grape to work with. And but from then on, the winemaking, it's gotten a lot more sophisticated as far as equipment, but the ingredients are still the same. And there were a lot of people making wine in their basement, and a lot of people making wine for the family, and I have every idea that some of it was pretty good. Some of it mm-hmm. probably wasn't so good. It can get away from you if you're not paying attention. But those were skills that were handed down from father to son. A lot of the immigrants that came here were from countries where wine was just part of their meal. It wasn't so much that it was part of their Saturday night hootenanny. It was something that they enjoyed as they had a meal. And so as they came and they settled and they raised their families, they brought those same kinds of cultural things with them, and they started making a little bit of wine.
I want to go back to this question of mining towns, because you talk about them, Tyler, in the piece of Vernal and Bingham Canyon. And I'm really intrigued by Corinne, which had per capita probably the most bars of any place in any city ever. It seems like there was a lot of drinking going on. Talk about Corinne.
Well, Corinne still exists, small town, just north of Salt Lake. They had 1,500 residents. At that time, it was just a dot on the map. It was out in the middle of nowhere. It was just a bunch of ramshackle department stores and mining sheds. And they had 1,500 residents, but they had 25 bars and saloons. You know, and that's quite a number. The Mormons called it the city of the ungodly. And probably much like Park City today, I would guess, right?
Sin City. Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and you know, there's some photos of it in the film, and you touched base upon the photos. And some of these photos we went through are just gorgeous, old photos of you know, and photos at that time were much more important. They weren't just taken on your phone. And you'd see these beautiful photos of the proprietor out in front of the bar, and, you know, people would be lining up and they'd hold their beer and they'd have these fantastic handlebar mustaches and the proprietor would be wearing an apron and they're standing very stately in front of these bars and they're just gorgeous. And we went through, you know, dozens and dozens of these beautiful black and white photos that add a real nice element to the film.
In the film, which you refer to, you were just mentioning before how alcohol generated really an incredible amount of revenue for Utah. What did you say, two-thirds?
Two-thirds in 1871, yeah.
And the taxes, you also mentioned in the film, the taxes were like five times than they were in a typical town like Chicago, for example.
Right, and the state taxed them very heavily. In 1873, Brigham Young, then the prophet and governor of the state, made it a law, passed a law that he and he alone should be the sole distributor of alcohol in the state of Utah. Now, did he do that to control alcohol or did he do it because it was financially prudent? You know, that's to be determined. But while there was a lot of alcohol here, there was a lot of taxes and a lot of people wanted a slice of that pie. And I think it still goes the same way.
Still a similar kind of conflict.
In a way, and when we're seeing a lot of loosening of laws in the state, as we've mentioned, and I dare say, and this is purely speculation, that that's based upon the recession we've had. If you want more revenue to the state coffers, one of the ways you can do it is to increase business, regardless of what business that is. And one business that is in demand in this state is alcohol, be it through restaurants or be it through distilleries or wineries or breweries. And I think we've seen a lot of loosening of the laws based purely upon that.
I want to get back a little bit before we head to a break, because I want to get the particular stories that you really tease out with Greg and David and Colin. But The effect of prohibition on this story, I think, is really interesting, and the influence that prohibition seemed to have on the way Mormons would come to see alcohol and their so-called word of wisdom. One of the people you use in the film is local reporter for KUTV, Rod Decker. I want to play a clip from him because he sort of gives you a kind of history of of the relationship between the LDS Church and laws in regarding all of this. Let me play a clip here because he talks about Rod Decker here, how the LDS Church really starts to kind of shift its position as prohibition comes into play. Here's a clip from Tyler Meesom's film, Beehive Spirits.
During this period, the Mormon Church gradually became stronger against liquor and tobacco. The word of wisdom moved from a principle to a rule. As it did so, most of the brethren became more favorable to prohibition.
What's the shift, do you think? It was sort of a general principle, a general idea. Now that it became illegal, do you think without prohibition, this is getting you to speculate, but do you think without prohibition, the Mormon word of wisdom would have looked like it does today?
Yeah, that's really, really hard to say.
Yeah.
I know that, alcohol wasn't frowned upon. And now Brigham Young hated alcohol. And while a lot of people drank it, he hated it. And he said, he was often known for saying wild comments about, stabbing people. But he said he'd no sooner kill a drinker than he'd kill a burglar or a thief. And I'm paraphrasing when I say that. But, he really abhorred the practice. But as the governor of the state, he recognized how much it came into play and how much the revenue was needed. So it's hard to say how it would have panned out had prohibition not come around. And one of the main tenets of the church that people look at is not drinking in any form, be it coffee or alcohol. I also have to quickly say that we say that it's my film, but Jenny Lynn Merton, who co-directed Sons of Perdition, we brought her on early and she came in from Brooklyn and really helped. She co-directed the film and she's a brilliant storyteller, and her and I kind of crafted the story together. And you, of course, you're a brilliant narrator in it as well.
Brilliant,
of course.
There were attempts to pass prohibition in the legislature. This is interesting. In the film, though, you point out it was the Republican governor, William Spry, who vetoed those attempts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's one of the surprising things you'll see is that Democrats were the ones who pushed forth prohibition. And Rod Decker goes into it. And Rod Decker, somebody said, all we know is a bit about alcohol. And he's writing a book on Utah politics. So we brought him in. We sat him down and we said, hey, Rod, tell us a little bit about alcohol in Utah. And 25 minutes later, he stopped. I mean, the guy just went and he had dates and names and figures and numbers. And he knew exact how many votes were, how much. And prohibition was not just passed once. It was pushed through and pushed through and pushed through. It was continually on the ballot. And eventually it got passed.
You talk about the 1916 election, which I think is really interesting. Simon Bamberger, familiar name here for those who know Utah's history. He was a Jewish governor. He came to be the first Jewish governor of the state. He ran on this idea of prohibition. I mean, he also, aside to running railroads, he also happened to own Lagoon, the amusement park in northern Utah. And he sort of took a leap. He mentioned that he was going to stop selling beer at Lagoon.
Yeah, and it cost him $5,000, which at that time in 1920 was a substantial amount of money. And like Colin said earlier, he was a Jew emigrated from Germany. And there were a lot of people coming from various cultures like Germany. And Wagner's Brewery was a German immigrant. Fisher's Brewery was a German immigrant. And they brought all that German brewing with them and made a lot of beer. So in that time, in 1916, it was a real upheaval. It was a great deal of back and forth among those who wished for prohibition and those who didn't. And that wasn't just in the state of Utah, but it was obviously throughout the nation. If you've seen the Ken Burns documentary, Prohibition, you'll know that it was quite a hot topic at the time.
And Utah was ahead of the game.
Utah was ahead of the game. In fact, on both ends of prohibition, Utah was the first one to put forth prohibition. And if we want to jump ahead to 1936, not 1936. When was prohibition? 28?
33.
Oh, God, that's a long time without a drink. That's a long time.
If people weren't drinking.
They were the first state to ratify prohibition. Yeah.
Which is an interesting story, which we may come back to, but I'm really interested in the night that right before Prohibition comes into effect, Rod Dekker tells a little story in your film about the Deseret News, which is good. Here's another moment from Tyler's film.
The night of Prohibition, the streets were full of people. Downtown, everyone stayed up late and got drunk. The Deseret News editorialized. It said, Prohibition will be the greatest benefit to mankind since Jesus Christ.
From Tyler Meesom's film Beehive Spirits, which is premiering tomorrow night at 8:30 on KUED Channel 7. There are other screening times that are going to be available. We'll give you the information about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Tyler Meesom with us, co-directed and co-produced the documentary Beehive Spirits. He's with us. Greg Scherf is the founder of Wasatch Brewery. He's here with us. David Perkins founded High West Distillery. Colin Fryer, the founder of Castle Creek Winery. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the surprisingly rich history of alcohol in Utah. Of course, the state has a reputation for temperance in this department, but if you go back a few years, you'll find a territory packed with places where you could get or distill a good stiff drink. Utah was home to some of the biggest breweries in the country. Most of its money came from selling alcohol. And then, of course, came Prohibition and stricter rules for Mormons, and the party seemed to be over. But over the last few decades, there's been this resurgence of brewing and distilling in the state. There's a new documentary that profiles all of this, and we are talking about it today. Tyler Meesom co-directed, co-produced the film. It's called Beehive Spirits. It's airing on the PBS television station KUED tomorrow. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. Tyler's with us, along with Greg Scherf, the founder of Wasatch Brewery, David Perkins, who founded the High West Distillery, and Colin Fryer, the founder of Castle Creek Winery. All three of them are profiled in the film. And Tyler, I wanted to talk about that, because this story isn't just about history. The story is about these three guys in some ways. In some ways, it's really about your sense of pioneers, because you saw the sort of pioneers from that time, and these guys are the pioneers from a new age, I guess.
Yeah. You know, Utah has a sense of a very interesting sense outside of the rest of the country. It's a very do-it-yourself. It's a very pioneering spirit of we can take care of it ourselves. And Beehive, essentially the Beehive State, is because they have this self-solidarity. We can make it ourselves, and that's hence the Valley Tan. They would make everything Valley Tan, and they'd call their own paper Valley Tan, and anything they made from scratch was Valley Tan, including whiskey. So they have this very I think it remains today. And we talk about the pioneers, people who fought for alcohol in the state, people who wanted alcohol in the state during the territory times. And one of the things we do is kind of translate that to today, which is three people who are smart enough, stupid enough, or crazy enough, or all three, to want to create alcohol in the state with the lowest per capita consumption of alcohol in the country. And we found these three guys, and they were fantastic. And we profile them, spend a day or two with each of them, and kind of show what they do.
It seems like, you know, you talk about industry and self-sufficiency. That's part of the sort of character that defines them. But there's that touch of rebellion that seems to be a factor.
I think there's a touch of rebellion now. Even more so. And I think anytime you have someone on the left, you have someone on the right just as extreme. And that's you find that in this state. And we've talked about this, Doug, is the fact that, you know, there's such a heady mix of artists and filmmakers and poets and music in this and a vibrant gay community in Salt Lake City. And on the other side, you have a very conservative, family-based Mormon religion. So I think you have quite a mix, and alcohol is something that mixes it up even a little bit more.
I want to talk about with you gentlemen that sort of the craft and the passion of it. But let me ask you about that for a moment, which is not to say that the idea for wanting to do this was based on your sense of defiance about this place. But how much did that in some way come into play, Greg Scherf?
Yes, it certainly came into play for me. Goes back to my Catholic education. The nuns used to tell my parents at every parent-teacher conference that I had an authority problem, that I was too rebellious and I wouldn't sit still and was defiant. So when I got out to Utah and realized what it was like to be a minority, and first time in my life having grown up white, Anglo-Saxon in the Midwest and part of the power structure, I got out to Utah and I thought, this is very peculiar. And I don't think I like it very much. And I was thought, should I stay? And I think I was really engaged to stay primarily because of the beauty of the state. One of the second trips I took when I got to Park City was to go down to southern Utah. And after that, I thought, this place is so remarkable. I think I want to live here. But I was in Park City, and that was kind of an enclave, and I didn't have to deal with being a minority very much. But as time went on, it did play on me, and I was looking for a way to express some rebellion and to do something out of the norm. And I call it a minority complex. I had a chip on my shoulder.
Right.
So part of that drove me. The other part was that I really wanted to start a business. I had a passion for beer. But it was a little a political urge that I had just to kind of say something to the majority culture that I'm here and I'm not going away and I'm going to exercise the opportunity to bring a different value, if you will. Not so much a value, but a different cultural experience.
Yeah. David, did you have any of that at all as you were thinking about it?
I'd say I did. It was sort of icing on the cake for me. I'm a contrarian by nature, and I love being told you can't do something. But I do like whiskey, and I did want to run my own thing. And I wanted to live in Utah regardless. I was coming here regardless. And if it went away and I couldn't do it, I'd do something else and I'd probably stay here. But just the idea was a lot of fun to be in Utah. And that's the one story. I travel a lot selling my wares.
Yeah.
And I love telling the Utah story. It's fun and people really enjoy it.
Colin, what about you? Did that idea of defiance or reaction, would that play any part for you?
It did. It wasn't the first part. For 15 years, I looked around the West to find a ranch where I could go ranching, and in the meantime, I'd fallen in love with the national parks, and I wanted to build a lodge that was like that within my means. And so when I moved to Moab, the only person I knew there was a realtor. It was a complete life change for me. In the meantime, as I got there, I met some people that had a winery. They were Mormons making wine. They made wine they never tasted.
And that's ever, all, right?
Ever. Well, they might have put it on their lips just for the – but anyway, and that could be a whole other documentary and another story. But as I discovered those guys and they were selling their winery, and I just thought, well, that would be a good addition to my lodge. And so that's when I sort of started finding out about the peculiarities of the law and how hard it was to change things. When I bought the winery, I found out they were paying almost 60% in taxes of various kinds. And I thought, wow, that's unfair. And I would go to the legislature and I'll just get that changed, because when they see that, they're going to think that that's not fair. And so I put on my suit and I just marched right up there and I got a couple of appointments and I went in and I started presenting my case. And pretty soon I found out that you can't just do that. And so I was discouraged and I went away, and then I had to do what a lot of other people have had to do. If you want to have influence in a legislature, is you have to get a lobbyist and you have to get a program and you have to approach it in that way. But it was a stark wake-up call for me that things aren't always necessarily fair, that you're going to have to, if you're going to play in this ball game, you're going to have to play by their rules. And that really got the hair up on the back of my neck. And I might have given up, except that it made me mad, because the winery wasn't a big part of my business plan. It was, an addition to it, and I was fascinated by it. But I didn't have much knowledge, or I hadn't really even gotten a passion about it yet that I have now. But when I found out how hard it was to get things changed, and the fact that it was legal to drink in the state of Utah, for heck's sakes, why is our legislature making it so hard for our businessmen and our farmers and our entrepreneurs to participate in that industry? All we are doing is sending our money off to the other states or other countries. And so I look at that in a common sense wise. It's not that we're trying to convert people who don't want to drink into drinking. You can drink if you want to. What we're trying to do is provide a local product to satisfy those kinds of needs.
It's been Greg Triff, it's been a part of your story too, that kind of trying to deal Well, there was some reaction by lawmakers to some of your marketing campaigns, mm-hmm. which have been
irreverent, perhaps.
Irreverent, yeah. You didn't want to be inoffensive, I think you've said. You wanted to be irreverent.
I wanted to draw attention to our product and also have a little fun at the same time. We did some of that over the years. Some of my favorites were the First Amendment lager. We touched on the taxation here, and I don't want to belabor that, but we are highly taxed. And then as a response to one of my ad campaigns, the state legislature openly admitted that they were going to impose a higher excise tax on beer as just a reminder of who was in control. And so we got in a bit of a dogfight about that. And I thought one way to – we couldn't change that law necessarily, but we could at least point it out. So we went out to the Great Salt Lake and had these kegs overpressurized, and we all dressed up in colonial costumes, and we dumped – this is when Tea Party was really pretty cool. This is before the current – Tea Party movement, but we kind of reenacted the Boston Tea Party by pouring beer into the Great Salt Lake, and we were all dressed up, and I pretended I was Ben Franklin and ran around saying, "Give me liberty or give me a cold one," and it was a good day.
Yeah, right.
And some of those antics, and you know, the other one that I think we're known for, and funny, David talked about his putting Porter Rockwell on his one of his whiskey labels. The story of the Polygamy Porter that we came out with was really originally about. We were going to make a beer I thought was so clever because I've read a lot of the Utah history that we were going to call a beer Rockwell's Porter. Mm. And I brought it to a focus group of young beer drinkers, and I asked them what they thought of the name because I was going to have the Angel of Death on the label, and I thought it was just a really cool story.
Right.
And they all looked at me like, wasn't he a painter? I go, no, he's the Angel of Death, you knuckleheads. You know, he's Brigham Young's bodyguard. This is a cool story. And they all looked at me like I was crazy. So I went back and got the sledgehammer out, and we just called it Polygamy Porter.
So I wanted to get a sense from David. Let me ask you, how do you explain the passion for this? Is it because you're crafting something? Is it based on just the fact that you really like fine whiskey? I mean, what is the essence? Can you explain it very well, the essence of your passion for all of this?
I think it's a conversion to all of the above.
Yeah.
I really like whiskey. I really like making my own whiskey. I love to eat. I like to cook. I'm a chemist by training. And it's the all those things wrapped into one. So I got very lucky to get paid to do it.
You said, Colin, that you have come to a kind of passion for it now, too. How do you explain it?
Yeah, well, the passion comes in that it's a mix of what I'm trying to provide for the public. It's it's unique to have cowboys making wine in southern Utah, and that you can come to the lodge and you can enjoy it, and it's part of that overall experience. And so for me, it's kind of about economic development and tourism and trying to neutralize some of the negative stereotypes that we have, and so if we can have a little beer, we can have a little whiskey, we can have a little wine, and it's made in our own backyard, I think that goes a long ways towards clearing the path for new visitors. They want to come and see us. I serve on the Office of Tourism Board, and one of the things we found when we're doing our focus groups is that we have we have some difficulty encouraging some people to come to our state because they don't understand our liquor laws, or they think they're a lot more cumbersome than they really are. And so I think with these gentlemen making the product here, and we know how to do it, and we're all trying to do it better every day, it's really competitive out there. And if we can make a quality product and people try it, I think it helps the overall sense of, what people think about our state.
Greg, what makes you good? What's the gift that you have to be good at this?
At making beer or just surviving in the business world of
making beer?
Beer. Obviously, these guys both touched on it. You know, a passion is important. You have to, you know, that old adage where you combine your vocation with your advocation. That's a great ambition to have, and if you're lucky enough to achieve it, it makes life pretty much, I think, more fun if you're doing what you like. So for me, I've never functioned as our brewmaster. I've always hired people with an expertise, scientists, if you will. We've got an incredible staff now. We've developed over the years, directed by a guy named Dan Burek, who's been with us for over 20 years. And when we get together and make a beer, it's more a collaborative effort. It's not one guy making all the calls, myself or any of the other brewing staff. We get together and decide whether we're going to make a beer that we have a target for, or whether we're just going to make another beer in another category. But we do it with four or five people involved, and we'll test brew it, and then we'll come out with the product. And, you know, we've over the last 26 years, we've gotten pretty good at it, I think. And in the old days, we used to say we made some really good beer, and unfortunately, we made some beer that wasn't really good. But I think the challenge of consistency is what has allowed us to survive and prosper, is to make really good beer really almost all the time. And I think that's an experience as much as anything. The passion is all great, but you got to learn how to do it, and you don't really learn without the practice of doing it. And we've been around long enough, and I think we've gotten pretty good at it.
David, what's the aspiration? Like, I want to be the best? I mean, how do you think about it in those terms? I mean, this is my goal. I want to be thought of in this way.
I think that's become the aspiration. Yeah. We sort of rocketed to the forefront of the whiskey world. Whiskey's changed a lot in the last 5 years, and suddenly there's this little old place from Utah making world-class whiskey. And we've sort of woken up saying, yeah, we can do it. And we've just committed to building a major plant that our partner, it's a dude ranch out in Wanship. And with the head there, we went around to Napa and Scotland to benchmark other places. And we said, we want to do it better. And we want to make a fun experience for people. And we really enjoy sharing it. And so, you know, if we can share it with more people, that's certainly our aspiration.
David Perkins, he founded High West Distillery. Greg Scherf is with us. He's the founder of Wasatch Brewery. Colin Fryer here with us, founder of Castle Creek Winery down in Moab. Tyler Meesom is with us, along with Jenny Lynn Merton. He directed and produced the documentary called Beehive Spirits, which is airing tomorrow night at 8:30 on KUED Channel 7. You can also catch a screening tonight at 7 at Brewies in Salt Lake City. Go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org, for more details. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the surprisingly rich history of alcohol in Utah. We're talking about a documentary co-produced by Tyler Meesom. It's airing on the PBS station KUED tomorrow. It's called Beehive Spirits. I wanted to read an email from Jennifer, who writes, "When you're headed west from Colorado, before you get into Heber, there's a place called Whiskey Springs. I've heard that's where Brigham Young or Porter Rockwell or someone stashed their whiskey." Does anyone know that story? David, do you know that by chance?
I've driven by there, and I've stopped with my dog to check it out, but there's no plaque there, and I really wish there was.
I know. We drove there all the time when I was a kid. Does anyone know anything about Whiskey Springs, Tyler?
I don't know. I know that during Prohibition there were a lot of stills set up all over the state, and we talk about it in the film, how many distilleries were busted. 400 distilleries were busted, and those were the ones they caught. So yeah. I suspect maybe it had something to do with an illegal still, but who knows?
You would think with the name, it's kind of not a huge leap to go to whiskey, right? Whiskey Springs.
You would think.
Here's an email from Jeanette, who writes from Farmington, New Mexico. She says, "I believe there's a confusion between the church and the members of the church. The church," she writes, "is not imposing their will necessarily, but the people who believe what the church teaches, that alcohol has a huge potential for abuse and thus making choices that are damaging to those around them." She writes, "The people elected to law making offices are being elected by a population that believes this. It isn't the church telling people what to do. It is people who see alcohol as a substance that needs to be controlled that are voting for lawmakers that will do what they can do to control it."
That's absolutely not true. The church clearly tells people what to do. It tells the state legislature what to do. It has gone on record saying that they have a voice and they have a right to do that, which I suspect with the First Amendment rights that they do. But it is simply not accurate to think that the church doesn't talk about this issue or give direction on this issue. They do.
Even the former commissioner, Kenneth Wynn of the DABC, he when we interviewed him, he said, "There is not a law that has been passed where the church did not have a direct say on alcohol." So, you know, I don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but it's pretty evident to see that they do have an influence on it.
I wanted to ask you about one of the things that comes out in this sort of the history part of your story is how the explosion of the highway system in the 1950s meant that the national breweries had this big advantage, and these smaller breweries kind of fell by the wayside, which sounds a little like what's going on with a lot of, you know, ma-and-pa retailers in local communities dealing with these big box stores and things like that, having to deal with the same kind of thing. Interesting. Did you notice that kind of connection?
Yeah. Well, as we had talked about in the film, that I think three breweries survived Prohibition. Fisher, Becker's, and I can't remember the third one. Maybe it was just those two.
I think just those two.
And Fisher closed in 1968, and it wasn't until our savior, Greg Scherf, brought back Wasatch that we had locally brewed beer. But I think, you know, 20 years ago, if you wanted chocolate, you ate a Hershey's bar. If you wanted a beer, you drank a Coors, and that was basically it. And while we are seeing a lot of smaller retailers go out of business in favor of Walmarts, I do think there's a resurgence of local food and local product and locally brewed beer and whiskey. And I think I for one, think it's beautiful. And in Utah, if there's one thing I know about Utahns, they like homemade, they like local, they like good quality product, whether it's food, clothing, or even beer. And I'm very thankful for the people that are entrepreneurial enough to start businesses in the state of Utah.
Are you noticing that?
Yeah, I have a take on that as far as how the industry evolved. I was growing up in Milwaukee, and in the smaller-sized breweries in those days, not the Schlitz or the Millers, but the middle-sized breweries, the Gettleman's and some of the others, were closing while I was growing up. So later on, when I had this idea of starting a brewery, I thought back and I went, why are all those breweries closing, and why do I want to open a brewery when there seems to be a real momentum going against new breweries? And then it dawned on me, it became clear, I think, when the craft brewery, we called it the microbrewery industry in those days because it was very micro. Now it's become a bigger part of the beer world, so we call it the craft beer industry. But the reason was that the smaller breweries, the mid-sized breweries, were making a product that was so similar to the Budweisers and the Millers and the Coors of the world that they didn't differentiate their product, and the consumer just looked at them as all beer. And they all made the same essential flavor of beer. And as a result, the guys with the lowest cost were the survivors. And they made a point of they would buy these mid-sized breweries and then just put them out of business and take their market share. So I think what allowed the craft industry to be born is that we chose a whole different product line. You know, we started out with ales and then branched out into all types of different unique, more esoteric type beers, gave the consumer some really fun choices that they didn't have just drinking American-style lagers like Budweiser. I suspect it was kind of true in the wine and the alcohol business. I mean, you make whiskeys, David, that are distinctly different than the Jack Daniels we grew up with.
You better be different or you're not going to be able to compete, and that's exactly right.
Have you seen that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, we're all, I said earlier, it's very competitive, the beer business, the wine business, the whiskey business. And so you have to have a brand. You have to differentiate yourself. What is it about you that makes people want to try your product? The first thing you have to do is get them to try it. If you make a good product, then you have a good chance they'll come back to you. But in our case, to differentiate ourselves is that, first of all, we're making wine in southern Utah in a climate that a lot of people initially would think is not favorable. We're cowboys making wine. That's kind of odd. And then, you know, we're approaching it as a tourism kind of a product as much as a wine product. We want people to come and enjoy and realize that Utah isn't necessarily the stereotype place that you can't have fun. You can have fun here, and Greg is probably the poster child for that. He's had a lot of fun all his life, and he's exported it to the rest of us.
What do you guys think is changing in terms of – David, I'll start with you. Is it that there's the population is now just becoming more diverse, and so the attitudes are changing, or do you think the attitudes themselves among, you know, a more conservative population, is that landscape shifting at all, do you see?
Well, I mean, there's a couple changes. You know, one is the change in state, and, you know, we have more outsiders.
Yeah.
So we have more consumers, in a sense, for our products, which is good for us. But changing in my world, maybe this isn't the intent of your question, is people are interested in locally produced things, craft things, and whiskey's hitting that. Beer hit that 15 years ago, and so did wine. But now people want to know what whiskey is. And so, you know, our job is to educate them, and the big guys don't do the job the same way as we do. So that change is probably the biggest change in my world.
Hmm. What do you think, Greg?
I concur. I mean, I think we touched on it. To get the consumer to move over from what they've been going to as a choice, you have to offer them something different. Certainly the quality has to be exceptional or they simply will move on. But there is, I think, in each of our industries, a real willingness to experiment and to be adventurous and to try a new product. Right now, you know, in the craft beer world, new is still the most powerful word. When people come into our pubs, they say, "What's new? What's your new beer?" And that's just, I think, an indication of what's driving our businesses, that people are looking for a new experience, and that's good for us, I think.
Tyler, I wanted to ask you, you described Salt Lake City as kind of a teenager that is in that stage of sort of really just breaking out. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, Salt Lake City is growing by leaps and bounds, and I dare say they have this teenage rebellion kind of the – and maybe not always so good, but slam the door on mom and dad and say, "I wish I'd never been born." And you're starting to see that kind of that rebellion and that turning away from authority. And I think it's good. I think it's very good for the growth of the city and the state and the people within it.
So what kind of reaction are you getting? These are the early days for to the film. What do you have expectations?
Well, you know, the film is we may get a little bit of flack from both sides. I think we're going to get a lot of people saying, "Well, why didn't you touch on the politics and how difficult it is getting a drink?" And we prefer, again, to talk about the history of it. The film is lighthearted. It's witty. It's funny. It's full of history. It'll give surprises and facts and figures that I think people don't know. We also have Del Vance in the film, who wrote the book Beer and the Beer Hive and owns the Beer Hive Brewery, or not brewery, but rather pub in downtown Salt Lake. And I think people just like that it's not – I love documentaries, and I've made a couple, and I'm making one right now. And they're a lot of times they're so dour and heavy, and this one's just fun and witty and goofy and shows three interesting people.
Tyler Meesom, along with Jenilyn Merton, he directed and produced the documentary Beehive Spirits, which is airing tomorrow night at 8:30 on KUED Channel 7. It's also screening tonight at Brewies in Salt Lake City. Just go to our website for the particulars. Tyler, thanks very much. And Greg Scherf, David Perkins, and Colin Farr, thank you all very much for being
thank
with
you.
Us.
Thank you. It was fun to be here.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.